Budgets are presented in billions, but they're felt in loaves of bread. Today, before the minister speaks next week, we're asking what the national budget looks like from a kitchen table. My guests to help us level up in preparing for next week's budget speech are from the Institute of Economic Justice, Mr. Liso Dukyana, whose work focuses on the political economy, labor markets, technology, and industrial policy, with a strong emphasis on the development that prioritizes human well-being. Dr. Siphesihle Qange, Agricultural Program Manager at Sirity Institute, where he oversees the implementation of the Social Employment Fund Program and agricultural process. His project works on the intersection of food systems, rural livelihoods, and local economic development. And Mr. Malvin Abrahams, Program Coordinator at the Peter Maritzburg Economic Justice and Dignity Group, which tracks and monitors essential items in food baskets across the country in the rands and cents of food inflation. All three of them perfectly placed with different perspectives of how the national budget translates into food prices and family survival. This year, going into the budget, we have to start with what drove such a big part of the conversation last year, which was VAT, and why it hit such a nerve in terms of the debate that was had when the VAT increase was initially tabled and then eventually the number that did become the VAT increase. Is VAT a regressive kind of tax in an unequal society the way that we are here in South Africa?
So from our perspective as the Peter Maritzburg Economic Justice and Dignity Group, value-added tax, particularly on food, is regressive. And it's regressive because it makes every food item 15% more expensive than it would otherwise have been. So when we look, for instance, at the food basket that we release the price of every month, it's a basket of 44 very basic foods, foods such as bread and peanut butter and a little bit of chicken and a little bit of potatoes and onions, etc. Very, very basic foods. Then we will see that the value added tax on the 22 foods in that basket that is VATable, that VAT comes to 342 rand and 50 cents. Now that equates almost to about 30 kgs of maize meal. When you talk about value-added tax on basic food that ordinary South Africans buy, then we are adding increase on value-added tax increases the cost of living for them, and therefore makes a basket of food unaffordable. And it was for that reason that we argued against a VAT increase.
Maybe let me ask the economist about this. You know, VAT is efficient for Treasury because you can't get away from paying it. But is it efficient for justice? You know, is it socially blunt, but efficient for Treasury, but socially blunt because of the way that it affects poor people in particular?
So, can I come in, Sisa?
Yes, Liso.
No, thank you. So, I think there's really two sides to the debate about EVET and the cost of living in general. So, the one side is what Mr. Mervin has just shined a light on, which is the issue that the cost of goods, the cost of food in particular, which is what most poor or lower class households spend most of their money on, the cost of that will go high. The other side of it is that is the income side. So the context in South Africa is that you have a lot of people that do not have work, that do not have jobs. And even where people do have jobs, they earn very little. So the median income in South Africa is quite low. So it means that even at the level at which prices are at, the households cannot afford simply because they do not have enough income to afford. And what is particularly maybe upsetting about izinto like EVET is that you are proposing this tax policy change in the context where you could have done other tax policies that might have been able to raise the same amount of money, but are not really targeted or will not have such a negative impact on poor people. So, for example, you could think about izinto such as wealth tax, land value tax, other kinds of taxes that may raise the same revenue, but will not disproportionately affect poor households as a VAT increase would.
So, I mean, you talk about this high unemployment and the tax burden on everybody. And I'm wondering just in terms of input costs as well, Dr. Siphosihle, maybe if you can come in and just talking about other factors that play a role in how these taxes then impact people on the ground.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much, for that. Me, I want to come from an angle of community, development, because that's where, I am. I'm in that sector. But first and foremost, is in terms of understanding, the VAT, what it means, especially there at the ground level. What I've learned over the years is that the communities, they do not know anything about the VAT. They just see the price inflation, and all of that. But in terms of the factors that are causing that, they are not really aware, and that calls for education around that, so that they understand. The reason why we sometimes, see this unrest in these communities saying, the fuel prices are up, and all of that. Sometimes at that particular point, there would be like, a practical, experience which led to, inflation and all of that. But because people are not, learned in terms of, what causes, such, they will just, cause those, unrest and protest without understanding the background and what has caused it. For instance, during the time of COVID, there was like a huge, a significant drop when it comes to fuel prices, but people were celebrating that, not knowing, what that could lead to. But then, to streamline or to narrow it down then to your specific question in terms of the factors, contributing to that. The one you have mentioned, the fuel prices, the fuel
electricity
prices,
exchange rates.
Exactly. So, for instance, if we take fuel price, can affect even other things. Let's say if fuel price increases, it will obviously impact the supply of inputs, and it will definitely have a significant impact now on those smallholder farmers, because it's going to be difficult for them to source those inputs. And then if they produce at a higher cost, then it means they will have to increase now their product prices, which now affects the entire community now, because even the farm gate prices will increase because the cost of production has increased due to increased fuel prices. So as I'm saying, it is very, very important also to bring in the education, when it comes to such, aspect in those rural communities, because now even the budget speech and all of that looks like high-level thing, for them. They do not understand all this, financial document that is being presented here, and it does not have any value, to them. They just, listen, hear it, listen about the jobs to be created, and it ends there. So we need to make it practical and, possible for them to understand such, terminologies and aspects.
Well, you talk about these big terms that are talked about, and Liso, I want to bring you back in here, just from a policy perspective. Is this really only about this volatility? Is it only about domestic policy, which is what the minister is going to be talking about? Or is there a global volatility that we also need to be thinking about and looking at in terms of the impact on how the minister's speech lands for us?
I think, okay, firstly, just to jump off on what specifically was saying about this lack of understanding of a budget. So firstly, we as the communities, we don't deal with spreadsheets, numbers on a spreadsheet. We deal with the service on the ground. It doesn't matter from the perspective of a community that the government gave 300 billion to the Department of Health. If when I go to the clinic, I still wait 2 hours, or when I have to be admitted in the hospital, I can go a day without experiencing food. So what part of the misalignment there is that what matters from the perspective of the community is service provision, it's state capacity, not a budget. The budget, we don't really experience it directly. What we experience as services, and then to your question, Sisi, it's kind of complicated because South Africa ultimately is what is referred to as an open open market economy. So there are factors that are external to us, so that are happening from the outside, from other countries, that will necessarily affect us, even if we haven't done anything. So because South Africa, for example, doesn't produce its own oil for petrol and things like that, factors that will affect petrol and therefore affect us domestically, as Uputi has said, we can't do too much about them. And then there will be the domestic things which are more or less in our control. So that will be the things like the electricity, how reliable it is, the price of electricity. That is something that the government can have a much more direct influence on. What is important, I guess, from the point of view of us who are listening to the budget and are hoping to be able to make sense of it and what it will mean to us, is to be able to separate those factors and to see whether our government is actually doing enough in the things that are within its power to control. So the government, yes, the government can control water. We are having a water crisis called Midrand, called Sentin. These are suburban areas. And we know that's something within the government's control. It can't say, "Hi, the global." No. It's within your control. It's you that is not investing in the infrastructure to ensure that the areas are serviced with water.
Well, you say that about listening to what the budget is and what these big terms are. And I'm interested to know, you know, Mervin, from your perspective and the work that you do and the people that you are engaging with on a daily basis, when the minister speaks next week, because it's going to be everywhere, everyone carries it, the news carries it, what should people be listening out for and how it impacts them? What are the big terms that they should be listening out for and what do those mean for them?
So I agree with the other speakers that when we engage with the budget, we engage with the budget from the perspective of our own situation. We cannot expect ordinary people to think macroeconomic policy. That would be going a bit too far. I would even be opposed to saying people should be trained in that way. We engage with the budget from where we are located within the South African economy. And so we have to understand that when the minister presents the budget, he presents the budget to really two very different groups of people in South Africa. I mean, he speaks to the financial sector, which is really a first world kind of body. And there he would speak about exchange rates, and he would speak about revenue collection and all of that. But we engage it from where we are. So the people I engage it with are people who are finding themselves without a job. And so they will be listening for measures to stimulate the economy in a way that can produce that level of work. So, for instance, when the minister speaks about, and if the minister will speak about government revenue going towards construction, towards infrastructure, towards industrialization, then, of course, for an ordinary person, that would be, well, can I get a job there? You know, so that's what they will be listening for. And then, of course, for those who are mothers who have children and who have to get the children to ECDs and into schools and into hospitals, like our other brother has just mentioned, they will be looking at, well, what is the social spending in the budget? You know, is government going to increase the child support grant? Now, one example, I mean, our research month after month shows that it costs about 948 rand to feed a child a proper nutritious meal a month. So mothers will be looking at, is the child support going to be increased? ECD workers and ECD people will be saying, you know, are we going to get an increase that would help us to provide that. So it depends on where you are located in the economy, will depend on how the budget will land with you and also what you will be looking out for in the budget.
And when we think about food security and jobs, you know, what would, for you, Dr. Sibisihle, what would a food secure budget actually look like? You know, where should Treasury be spending in order to ensure that we have a more food secure budget for the people?
All right, you know, talking about that, I think like last week when during the SONA, State of the Nation address, I think the president mentioned, in terms of the improvement when it comes to agriculture. But if you realize, those insights were mainly, reflecting the commercial side of things, because you mentioned the citrus, industry in terms of, exporting more, markets being available and all of that. But looking, into that, there was little or nothing has been said when it comes to smallholder, farming, especially in rural areas, of which if you look at the agriculture, as a whole, it's the main contributor to the GDP of the economy. And if you look at the landscape of the farmers, a lot of farmers are small-scale farmers, but is there any investment towards those farmers? Or maybe they are fine as the small-scale farmers, of which they are still facing challenges, even as the small-scale farmers. It was going to be like a different language if we were saying they are small-scale, but like they are sorted maybe. The limitation is just the availability of land, of which it's not only availability of land, there are also other, factors that, government should be looking into, like production inputs, the prices, and all of that. Currently now we've got, farmers, livestock farmers, which are being affected by the mouth and
foot and mouth,
disease. And also, whenever there is a pandemic, medication tends to be very expensive because even the supply is limited, as the president has mentioned, that they are also still trying to get this medication, and all of that. So obviously it's expensive, but how are small-scale farmers, assisted, in terms of that, except that they must, isolate their livestock. So, I think then we really want to, improve food security, let us also pay more attention to small scale farmers, because a lot of food is coming there. If we talk of, food security, we can say South Africa is food secure, as the nation, but at the household level, what is happening? That's where people are. If we're going to be talking of like the exports, and all of that, But locally, what are we consuming? Because that's what's going to, you know, say we are food secure, if we are eating like on the ground. So to say we are exporting more of maize, we are exporting more of what, that doesn't mean anything, you know, for us, you know, on the ground. Like I said, that I will be sort of advocating for the communities, because that's where, you know, my passion is. I'm working with these communities. We are struggling, even us, to visit the site. Infrastructure is bad. I heard, like, from the SONA, there's a lot of investment going to infrastructure development, but that is not rural, I can assure. It's not rural infrastructure that is being referred to. The areas, it's hard to reach, especially after heavy rains. Cannot visit them to see the farmers, how are they doing after those, you know, natural disasters, to see where can we assist. It becomes difficult because the infrastructure is bad, you know.
Lisa, so, and you know,
focus more on the community or, you know, smallholder farmers. You know, I think we can improve.
And agriculture. Lisa, the minister often speaks about kind of debt servicing. Do you feel that the debt servicing is possibly crowding out on that spending? And to Sipisile's point that agricultural investment could stabilize prices, could we afford both? Can we afford? Treasury prioritizes fiscal consolidation, and he's talking about stabilizing at farmer level. Can we afford both?
So just maybe to start on the first in terms of farmer level and food prices, I think the typical South African household, we buy our food and our foodstuffs from retailers. We don't buy directly from the farmers. We buy from retailers. And what it means is that there has to be a bigger assessment of how, for example, the market structure of retailers affects the food prices. You have a relatively concentrated retail sector dominated by the companies such as Shoprite or Pick and Pay, Woolworths and the such. And those are very important in the price setting context. So it's not just, for example, farmers, of course, are important, but they are on the other stream of the retail chain. And then in terms of fiscal consolidation, I think it's clear that that is the one policy South Africa has not been able to afford, even though it's the one that is being put up as the one that is necessary for the country to get out of whatever financial crisis or financial problems we have been in. So if fiscal consolidation in the last, let's say, 15 years has meant that there are less teachers for every student, it has meant that there are less nurses for every patient, it has meant that social grants have not increased at the rate that is necessary to make sure that households are able to afford food, are able to assist children, and are able to take care of the elder. So if there's one policy that the Minister of Finance should definitely be thinking of abandoning, which has not even worked in terms of being able to stabilize a debt, because what it also means is that if you are spending less on the economy, and that typically means that you also have a negative impact on the economic growth. So for us, it's a non-starter. We think in general, in terms of being able to stabilize the food prices, there is a place for fiscus to play a role there. But as it comes to debt servicing costs, we think fiscal consolidation is definitely not the preferred way in which this can be done.
Mervin, do you feel that?
If I can just come in on sure. that too, and I would fully agree that there is an obsession around fiscal consolidation. Now, when you look at a household budget, for instance, you can well understand that a household cannot borrow more than it can afford to pay back. But that's a household. A country budget doesn't quite work that way. So if we grow the economy, as the economy grows, the debt versus GDP automatically decreases. Because it's only in relation to that it makes any difference. So it's debt, but not debt just by itself. It's debt in relation to GDP growth. That's where the problem is. And so our problem is that we have not grown our economy over the last five or decades. I mean, 1% growth is taking us nowhere. When we have 150,000 young people entering the labor market every year. So we have to, when we come to debt consolidation, really we have to take a long-term view. We have to say, what do we need in order to grow our economy? Because as we can grow our economy, so our debt will actually lessen over a period. So what are the steps? So let's invest in industrialization. Let's invest in food security on a massive scale, looking at food as part of a food system, a system that starts with climate and that ends at the table. And in between there are many, many actors and many, many places where government, whether it's national government, but also local government can intervene at. Let's really focus around growing our economy. And if we can get that right, then we automatically will begin to solve our debt problem. The problem is if we focus on debt and only on debt repayment, then as my fellow panelists have said, then the effect would be less economic growth, less employment, less everything else, and then we go into austerity. And no country has ever saved themselves out of austerity.
So our minister's basically just managing our poverty and not reducing it.
Exactly.
Well, I'm quite interested also to understand, Mervin, from your work and your perspective, how this food inflation and effectively this extra tax on poor households has impacted the behavior of these families and how it affects the society.
So when we look, for instance, at food, so let's start at the beginning of the month when income comes into the home, okay? Because as was said before, South Africans are net buyers of food. We don't grow much. We buy. So when income comes in, women tell us that they prioritize four, really. And this is the order in which they prioritize. They first must ensure that there is transport for that worker that works and brings in a wage, because without transport, that wage is gone. So that's priority number one. Number two, electricity, both for cooking purposes, for food preservation purposes, but also for security, and also for it has an educational value so the kids could study. The third area is debt servicing, because midway through the month, the money runs out. They need to go back to the retailer or the money lender, whoever, to get. Only then do they purchase food, okay? Only then do they purchase food. So when these other three costs escalate, so when fuel prices escalate, when Eskom comes with a 15% increase in tariffs, it means that there is less money available for food. So what are the options? So women have one of two options. They either cut back on the amount of food they eat. So quantity of food gets less in the household. And they also cut back on the quality of the food that they eat. So quality and quantity is cut back within the household. Now, we might say, okay, that's the way we manage our budgets. But you've asked, what is the impact on society? So this is the impact on society. The impact on society is that our child stunting will continue to be at 25%. And stunted children have been shown, through no fault of their own, but they cannot study. So because it's a cognitive condition. So our investment in education, when the minister celebrates, well, we are increasing our educational budget by so many billion, well, that money is going to stunted children who are not unable to actually use it. The second thing is we will have a higher disease burden. So we would have to go more to our clinics. So we would require a greater health budget. So, and then of course, when these young people enter the workforce, they are more likely to enter the workforce as laborers rather than contributing into this new global economy. So it has major economic problems for South Africa. And if we want to solve in the long term our economic growth issues, we actually have to look at sufficient and nutritious food at the table from the moment a woman knows she has conceived, mother before birth, social grants or support, and in particular the 1,000 days after the birth of a child, and then support those children through life. But that is absolutely necessary.
Sure. So personally, that then brings me to a question around the social employment fund. And another part that hasn't been, we don't know, up in the air is with the unemployment grant that the 350, 360, I think it was increased to last year. That's only been extended till March 2026, and we don't know what's happening after that. And you work with the Social Employment Fund and its continuity. What do you think the role of that in terms of our economy and what the minister should be considering can still be?
All right, so I think the one you're referring to is the Social Employment Fund program. But there are a lot of these programs under the presidential employment stimulus. I think the 350 that you're referring to is the social relief grant.
Yes.
Yeah, but me, I'm on the Social Employment Fund program. That's where we employ people across different thematic areas. The president mentioned last week on the SONA about the 2.5 million opportunities that have been created through the presidential employment stimulus. But the I think the concern around that is in terms of sustainability, because these opportunities are usually short term. And within that short, time frame, those participants or beneficiaries are expected to build their confidence and also to be competitive in the labor market, of which it's highly impossible within short period of time. Hence, that threatens now the long term impact of that initiative. So I think one thing that government must look at, when it comes to these initiatives, is the term of which that is obviously guided by the budget. So if we could invest more in such initiatives, I think there is a lot more that we can see out of those programs, such as a Social Employment Fund program. I've got, a practical example of, of what I'm talking about. Yes, the RIT Institute, we have been, implementing this program, in four provinces. But I want to pick up, a practical story from Delpan, which is one of the most vulnerable villages in the northwest province. And I like making an example about Delpan, because when we got there, I think it was like 2022, they were like affected by the flooding, so everything was like washed away. People had no houses, no businesses. There was like nothing. And then we created about 100 job opportunities. We employed people. They started establishing food gardens around the community, so that at least the people, they can get food cheaper now because it's closer to them. Their nearest town is like 60 kilometers away. So imagine like getting food was also a struggle because there is nothing, locally. But I'm telling you, to date, in Delpan, we have employed, over 500 people, and we've established, an agri-node. I think in common terms, it's agri-hub. So that's where, we produce a lot of vegetables. We aggregate for smallholder farmers around. We link farmers to the market, and all sort of those activities. So that hub is sort of, an economic, engine now for that particular community. And also the value chain, has been shortened now. They get everything, local and all of that. And also we've got stories of participants as a result of that program who have established their own enterprises now graduating from the program, So that's why I'm saying now, if these, initiatives can be at least made longer, funded, more than, the current structure, of funding. So there's always uncertainty when it comes to funding. So imagine now enrolling people and saying the program is only for 10 months and you are expected now to establish your own business. We know that is impractical. So I think that's the thing that needs to be restructured when it comes to the program. Otherwise, its design, I think it's unique and it's working because it has transformed many lives. As I'm talking to you now.
Sure.
So if I could just come in now.
Let's start with Liso and then we'll come to you, Mervin.
Thanks. If I could just come in on the 350, the Social Relief of Distress Grant. So my sense is that this grant is one which actually exposes hypocrisy within the government and its budgeting processes. Because if you remember, the dominant narrative in South Africa has been that one of our biggest problems and which has led to our public finances to sink is the fact that the government is spending money on the wrong things. So finally now you have a program which has a very wide reach, which has had very clear positive impacts on the lives of people because people have this money and are spending it in their local economies. It's allowing people to go out and search for work. It's allowing people to maintain a livelihood, even as small as it is, and it should be high. And yet, now that this program is showing fruit, you are saying you want to put barriers that will make it less impactful. You are creating bank verification that are leading to people being incorrectly being put out of the system and not able to receive a grant as they should. And again, the other aspect in which it touches to is that you have had time as the government, you have had many years to try and make this grant permanent because it has clearly been a good thing for most South Africans. You have had time to develop a basic income support policy, and yet you have not done that. Now you have this uncertainty. You have this uncertainty you are creating for the public, but you also have this uncertainty you have for a public finances because now if the Minister of Finance does not budget for just for this item, and yet 2 or 3 years down the line, there is a resolution by the government that there must be a basic income support for all South Africans or for South Africans that really need it. Then you will claim as the Ministry of Finance that all public finances have been thrown to a risk, have been whatever. Why did you not budget for it?
Yes.
Because it's a program that is clearly working. Why are you not incorporating it now into the fiscal framework? So I think the SRT grant is something which really shows where a government failure has been in terms of budgeting.
Well, okay, Mervin, I'll give you the last word.
Yes, so the South African economy and the way we've worked with our macro economic policy contains major contradictions. So in the narrative, we say, well, government is you know, supporting too many social grants. There are just too many people on social grants. It's absorbing the entire budget. Yet at the same time, we are not focusing on that which can take people off grants, which is jobs and job creation. So really, when it comes to, we believe we can bring those two things together. And I just want to tell a story of a project which was stimulated. I mean, I thought about it when the panelist previous spoke about, you know, the employment stimulus work. We as Peter Marisburg Economic Justice and Dignity, we had for a long time argued that what South Africa needs is an economic stimulus. We ordinary people need to get the money that not only leads to survival or subsistence, so food, electricity, and a roof over their head, but that they have a little bit of money left over in order to create their own kind of economic livelihoods. Because you get what you pay for. Okay, so if you're going to give somebody 350 as the SRD grant, you are going to get the value of 350, which is 5 or 20 loaves of bread. That's all you can buy. You can't create an economic opportunity because of that. So what we did about 3 years ago, and we've just concluded our research, is we took 100 TVET college-trained unemployed youth, and we gave each one of them unconditional cash transfer, unconditional, of 2,000 Rand per month. 2,000 Rand, so that it's above the upper bound poverty line, so that the whole thing are not consumed by food and transport. And after 24 months of that process, we got back those young people to see what they have done with that money. And 67% of those 100 had either found permanent employment or they had started an income generating opportunity from which they were getting money coming to themselves on a monthly basis. Wow. And it seems to us that we, well, number one, we need to trust people, that people know what they can do with money. You get what you pay for. So if you're going to give somebody just enough money to buy a loaf of bread, well, then that's all they're going to buy, a loaf of bread. But we actually have to invest in those children, those young people that we have already trained, TVET trained, they are skilled, and give them the means to create their own kind of employment, because South Africa cannot find enough jobs for 40% of young people who are unemployed. So, sure. So there are a number of these really good things that have been tried, and I think we need to begin to ask, well, what worked, where did it work, and how can we upscale it? And there is money for that. I mean, the question is always, well, there aren't any money. I mean, why is there millions and billions sitting in these skill sector funds doing nothing? You know, let us give that money to young people we have already trained through our educational system and say, 24 months, we're giving you this money. Part of this money, you've got to start investing in your own business. And after 3 years, you're on your own. Create your business and see what happens.
I think that's a wonderful place to end this conversation. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. And if anything, I think from this conversation, there's a clear understanding that fiscal policy doesn't just live in the spreadsheets of the minister. It also lives in our homes. And I hope that for all the people who are listening today, when they listen to the minister speak next week, they're not just asking themselves what these big numbers actually mean, but also how it translates to their fridges every day. Thank you very much.